you a little bit of information about, I'm going to give everyone a little bit of information about Roger, and then I'll ask him to come on and give us some more background information before we dive into the questions. So Carrie and I were interested in bringing Roger into the call because we're both interested in sustainability as a form of development in emerging markets. And Roger definitely is doing effective work in that field. He is a capital market pioneer. His work is primarily focused on international and emerging markets and microfinance. His company, Innovar, works at the intersection of financial innovation and agriculture to create financial instruments which provide attractive market rate returns while addressing some of the most important developmental issues in the world, such as food security, climate change, and economic empowerment. Previously, Roger worked as a partner at Development World Markets, where he was part of a team that structured and placed the world's first capital market transactions for microfinance, Blue Orchard Microfinance and securitization, which we'll talk about later on in this call. These transactions were the first time that international capital was used as a fundraising tool for microfinance, and the models have helped to create billions of dollars of financing in the field. Previously, Roger spent 20 years working on Wall Street and is one of the first U.S.-based investment professionals to work in international and emerging markets. So we're really looking forward to hearing a little bit more about Roger's work. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Roger, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about the work that you have done and currently are doing.
Great. Well, thank you, Justine, Carrie, and Evan, for the chance just to share a couple of thoughts about some of the work that I've done. And it's a pleasure to meet everybody on the phone. What I thought I would do is make about 15 minutes worth of comments, roughly broken down into a little bit of my background and my own personal path and what led me to the work in microfinance and how I use that as a springboard for some of the work that I'm doing now around agriculture. And I think I'll start the first part of my presentation by saying don't do this at home, or it's not a career path that I would recommend for the faint of heart. You know, I like to joke that I knew I wanted to work in international finance and business, so I got a degree in fine art and art education. And if this finance thing doesn't work out, it's nice to know that I have a fallback career. but that is literally what I did. I had studied the University of Delaware. I was part of a group of artists called the Art Squad, and what we did was to put on environmental art happenings to raise awareness around the environment and environmental issues. I taught handicapped adults. I taught women prisoners. I worked with a variety of alternative populations and then did the next logical career move, which was to sell most of my possessions. In the ages of 23 and 24, I spent the better part of a year living out of a knapsack in Eastern and Western Europe. Spent a lot of time behind the Iron Curtain, spent a lot of time in North Africa, and everybody said, you know, when is Roger actually going to grow up and get a job? Well, I came back to the States. I was living in the East Village, you know, working as an artist and doing some freelance work, and a friend of mine happened to be in the business school at New York University, and he said, you know, come join me for a class, and then we'll have some dinner afterwards. So I'll never forget, actually, sitting in that classroom looking at about what I consider 200 penguins and saying to myself as I was listening to the teacher, this stuff is pretty interesting. And then he began to talk about exchange rates in countries I had just visited, and the next thing you know, I was raising my hand arguing with the professor because he was actually factually wrong about countries that I had just visited. So long and the short is I ended up getting an MBA from NYU in Finance and International Business. Ran a student consulting group called UBAC, Urban Business Assistance Corporation, and spent almost two decades on Wall Street in emerging and international markets. And as I like to joke, I got to go back to some of the places I had visited, and no longer did I need to sleep on park benches. Never did the word development cross my lips, but in retrospect, when I think about some of the transactions that I was involved with, for example, financing the telecommunications infrastructure in Poland right after the wall came down, it absolutely was very much rooted in development because by building the infrastructure, whether it was telecommunications, whether it was roads, whether it was services, not only did it increase employment, but it really dramatically helped improve economic growth. Did that for a number of years. Literally, at this point, I've traveled and worked in around 70 countries around the world. But Wall Street, for a variety of reasons, was changing. It was very entrepreneurial when I began, and I got to know my colleagues at Developing World Markets. They were managing an emerging market portfolio and began to explore doing some kind of microcredit financing. And I was familiar with microfinance because the banks in South Africa, where I'd done a lot of work, actually consider it an important part of their portfolio because of the nature of the clients that they're working with. So my partners and I actually had the very good fortune to structure and place what was the first cross-border capital raise for microcredit. And 80% of what we did was really an off-the-shelf kind of Wall Street financing solution. It's called the collateralized debt obligation. But the real magic came in, and this is where, you know, a background in the arts and a background in creativity really came in handy, because while it was a very rigidly structured financial instrument, the front end and the back end really had to be customized because no one had really tried to use capital markets to finance emerging markets around the world. And we created the first microfinance bond, but the phone, as you can imagine, was not ringing off the hook. And I shared with my colleagues an article that I had written that was published in Stanford Social Innovation Review. And I'll just highlight one example of some of the challenges because it illustrates, you know, the kind of issues. We created the bond, but nobody was going to be buying it. And we began to brainstorm and think about who the potential investors could be. And it was clear a lot of foundations were very committed to issues around women's economic empowerment. So I began to get in touch with some of these foundations, met people on the program side, showed them the pretty pictures of the women and the girls and all these wonderful things. And we'd hold hands and sing Kumbaya, push the chairs away and sit on pillows. And at the end of a 20-minute love fest, they would say, you know, we love what you're doing, but we don't invest. We actually give money away. You need to speak to Charlie, who runs the endowment. So I'd pick up the PowerPoint, and we'd speak to Charlie, and I'd show him the pretty pictures. And the next thing you know, Charlie would just sort of get this disgusted look and said, we can't invest in something like that. So after I did this a bunch of times, having been trained in the trenches of Wall Street, I still would start my meetings with people on the foundation side because they would get me into the door. But instead of actually showing the presentation to Charlie, I would begin to ask him questions like, do you invest in emerging markets? And, of course, as an astute investor, he did. And then I began to ask, do you invest in financial institutions in emerging markets? And, of course, he was such a smart investor that, of course, he did. And then I began to share with him some of the financial ratios of these microfinance institutions, which were so far superior to any commercial banks around the world. He actually began to start to pay attention, and it was really only after Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize that, you know, investors really started to get much more engaged, and it's amazing how much smarter I was on that day than I was the day before. But it was a very long and arduous journey to start to get some commercial acceptance for this extraordinarily bizarre instrument, and ultimately the models that we'd created, we won a Fast Company Award for the financial innovation, and the subsequent issues that most of the major Wall Street banks did were all modeled after the work that we had originally done, which in essence tiered risk and tiered returns so that we identified different investors with different motivations and segregated the bond in ways that addressed what the risk appetite, what the return expectations are for a whole spectrum of investors. Love microfinance, did that for about 6 or 7 years, but I'm somewhat restless, and I was always frustrated with the issue or the challenge of, if you don't live to the age of 20, you're not going to need a lot of microcredit. So how can the capital markets be used as a tool to really have a positive impact on people's lives while making money for investors? Because in my view, greed is a tremendous motivator. And to really get the kind of capital to address all these developmental issues that are around, we really need to use greed and capital markets as the tool. Just an interesting point of fact, if you add up all the philanthropy in the world, it's less than 1% of all the capital markets. So the wallet size just isn't big enough, which is really what's driven most of my work over the last decade. So after about 6 or 7 years of microcredit, I began to talk with my now partners around Innovari around these questions and these challenges, and we realized that the only way to address these issues in scale was through agriculture. Because now, in the language of development, which I've learned to speak over the years, when you begin to think about agriculture, it touches on some of the most fundamental and critical developmental issues. Food security, climate change, health, nutrition, improved cognition on the back of nutrition. And there were not only many ways that we thought we could make a dramatic difference in people's lives, but there are also just a tremendous, tremendous number of investment opportunities. So we formed Innovari Advisors to really focus in around agriculture and what we call climate smart agriculture. And we've been working on a variety of projects under that broad umbrella. Just to give you a flavor and a sample of some of the things that we're doing, we did a lot of analysis, and the team that I put together has just extensive experience in Africa, in development, in agriculture. I, you know, look at the world through a financial lens, and my colleagues are always amused when I talk about organics and describe them as the virtue of planting garlic next to the tomato and the lack of need for pesticides. But at this point, I'm dangerously conversant in the world of agriculture and organics. But one project that we're doing, we did a lot of analysis in the capital markets and recognized that in Africa in particular, there was an absence of debt capital. Fair amount of equity, but particularly for small and medium enterprises, the banks weren't lending because the customers were too small, and the SMEs in particular were too big for the microfinance institutions. So a huge market gap was around SME and or debt financing. We did a lot of analysis around food production, and this is where I defer to my colleagues who are truly global experts in this field. And we realized that as sexy as the smallholder is, and this is the farmer that has a hectare or two, most of whom are actually women, but the problem, or as sexy as they are, is not actually the production, but it's really the processing. It's the refrigeration, it's the transportation, it's the logistics, it's the equipment needed to get the raw product from the farm actually to the market. So one of the projects that we're actually launching right now is a leasing facility. 2 years ago, I was speaking at the State Department on issues around food security, and we met with the president of a company that's an expert, a global expert in soybean manufacturing. And they had tens of millions of dollars in orders in Africa, but they didn't have the ability to finance it. So the leasing facility that we're about to launch with them will be started in Kenya, soon to expand to Ghana and Nigeria, soon to expand to other equipment manufacturers, but ultimately it's about creating a turnkey solution so that these SMEs and in turn the smallholder farmers can get access to equipment which will increase their productivity and in turn improve livelihoods. That's one project. Another is with a company called GrainPro. You might be familiar with these somewhat romantic images of burlap sacks that carry dry grains and seeds. The reality is that 30 to 40% of what's in those sacks actually goes to waste, either through fungus or through insects just eating it. And what GrainPro has is a technology which was actually developed in Israel. It was originally a plastic used to wrap tanks, which grew out of the Six-Day War. That's turned into hermetic storage bags, which kill the insects and don't allow any fungus to grow. So the actual yield from those bags, instead of being 60 to 70%, is now 100%. Plus, the farmer doesn't have to sell their commodity when it comes when at the height of the season, they can actually store it for a few months. So you're increasing livelihoods, one, by not being tied to the vagaries of the market. Farmers can actually sell a few months later when prices are better. And two, the actual amount of commodity that you're producing actually increases up to 100%. So it's been about 15 minutes, which was my allotted time for an introduction. You know, we're working on a lot of other projects, but the ones that I gave you hopefully will give you a sample. Let me pause for a few minutes and just, Justine and Carrie, I'll defer to you, but can I suggest we just open up the floor to questions?
Hi, Roger. Thank you. That was really great. We definitely have quite a few questions for you. The first one, I'm wondering, after reading your article in the Stanford Review, I saw that one of the questions that you asked was, what is philosophically different or new about impact investing? doesn't significantly differ from many examples of commercial finance. And I'm wondering if you can talk about what the differences between impact investing and traditional commercial finance are, and how you distinguish between that in the work that you do in your company.
Sure. Great question. Let me share with you a couple of thoughts and observations, because fundamentally the answer is no. Philosophically, I have a bit of a problem with impact investing, and the reason is because, and what's different is there's a much greater emphasis on the social returns. Commercial capital moves much more quickly than impact capital. You know, I've been working in this field for a while, and there are times when, frankly and candidly, I miss Wall Street. And what do I mean by that? Because you have investment managers who are making decisions, and either they make the right decision and make money, or they make the wrong decision and lose money. But there's a speed of capital around Wall Street, which just is what sort of characterizes the industry. The impact investing world is making the same decisions, but very frequently what I found is there's so much analysis around the social impact that it's also led to a lot of paralysis. Another issue that I found, too, is that a lot of the world of impact investing is not geared towards the commercial and capital markets. And please understand, I love impact investing, and many of my friends are involved with NGOs, but there's a fundamental disconnect between commercial capital and the responsibilities of a fiduciary and a lot of the investment vehicles which are existing in the impact world. For example, by definition, a fiduciary cannot invest in an NGO. That's just the law. So by using a new vocabulary around finance, while philosophically I laud what impact investing is trying to do, it's actually slowed the process down, in my view, in terms of bringing commercial capital. I talked earlier about my experience, you know, opening up many, many capital markets to building factories. And, you know, I was always ambivalent because, you know, personally, you know my background is in the arts. I love local handicrafts. And is it a good thing or a bad thing to build a factory in some of these local markets? You know, it's good because you're creating jobs, you're creating employment. But what happens to the local culture and the artisans? So it's a confusing and it's a really challenging issue because very often people get more hung up on the vocabulary than the actual investing process. Let me pause there and see if that either helps or is more confusing.
No, that was a very great answer. Thank you so much. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little more about the different leasing financing facility that you've developed. I'd love to hear the details about that.
Sure. The philosophy of it is fairly simple. Most SMEs can't afford a $250,000 piece of equipment. But if you break that down into paying it for over 3 or 4 years, not only are the payments much more manageable, but the farmers actually now have money to buy the seeds and buy all the materials. This is also what's called financial leases, leases to own. The life of this equipment is actually much, much longer than the 3 or 4 years of the lease. Unlike a car or a new piece of technology, which you want to upgrade after 3 or 4 years, soy processing equipment is pretty standard stuff and fortunately doesn't have a lot of moving parts, so it doesn't break down quite as much. So the reason that we're pretty excited about this program is because, one, there's tremendous need for it. Two, some of the early users that we've already identified are donating their food to the World Food Programming. They're using it for animal feed to improve nutrition. From a commercial perspective, what we're offering is a 4-year note yielding 7%, which in a yield-starved environment is a very, very attractive instrument. Plus, if you'll allow me to put on sort of my financial hat for a minute, the instrument is well over 100% collateralized, meaning there is very little risk. And that's broken down as follows. 25% down payment from the user. The company itself has agreed to buy back the equipment at 50 cents on the dollar. The reason they're so interested and eager to do that is because they can't meet demand globally. We've been working very closely with the African Guarantee Fund, and they've put up another 50% guarantee. Plus, we have a guarantee from our local leasing partner who's going to be doing the actual credit work on the ground. So from an investor's perspective, they're getting a four-year note yielding 7%, which is well over almost 150% collateralized, and it's going to have dramatic and significant social impact because it's going to enable these smallholder farmers to boost their income, improve the quality of the nutrition through the soy, and it's a model that we hope to expand to other regions. Now, through Inivari, we're actually exploring two initiatives. One is this commercial initiative, which I've just mentioned. The other is through a consortium of local partners, including Agra, including some groups out of India. And for this venture, we're looking for some soft funding, some philanthropic capital, and we're very clear about, you know, Inivari itself is, we're a commercial investment advisor, investment bank, fund management company. But as part of this consortium, a lot of the capital we're seeking will be going towards education. It will be going towards building the co-ops. It will be going towards building an infrastructure with the ultimate goal in 3 years for this to be self-financing. In other words, we hope to use the philanthropic funding that we're seeking right now as first loss equity, which ultimately becomes catalytic capital so that this enterprise is self-sustaining. You know, everything that we do, either on the commercial side or when we dabble in the world of philanthropy, is not to compete with the other models that are out there, but to really use that capital in a way that it becomes catalytic and meaningful. And as reading into my comments, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about the many shades of money, and this grows back to some of the early work in microcredit, by really, really being able to segregate risk, return, and expectations on the financial side and expectations on the social side. So let me pause there.
Thank you, Roger. So just a follow-up question to that. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about who your customers are. So what, you mentioned two examples of projects that you've funded so far through Inivari, but can you tell us about the people that you're working with and the impact that you are having through these financing projects?
Well, there are a variety of ways to answer that question. On one hand, it's groups needing capital. You know, or companies like a GrainPro or a company that's a leading company in organics, they just don't know how to package themselves typically. And in a sense, I used to call myself a reformed investment banker, but at the end of the day, in fact, that's exactly what we're doing is we're identifying these good investment opportunities and we're coaching and we're training and we're getting them ready to work with capital. So on one hand, the groups of people we work with are these kind of enterprises. On the other hand, we're working with many, many of the development groups. I mentioned the State Department, USAID. We're working with many of the development financial institutions around the world, OPIC, FMO out of the Netherlands, DEG in Germany. Another group of constituents is our commercial investors. You know, we're working with some of the SRI-oriented funds, the impact funds. We're working with many commercial investors who look at collateralized-backed lending in the case of some of our leasing programs. And then there's just kind of a whole world of either celebrities or presidents or princesses or groups that just really care about this that are really starting to build momentum. So, you know, it's a long-winded way of saying, you know, somebody once asked me what one of my biggest challenges is, and the answer is it's actually knowing how to dress. And the reason is because, you know, sometimes I'm speaking to a board of directors and there's a certain look and a certain approach there. Sometimes I'm speaking to sort of a venture capital community. A lot of times I'm actually on the road. I was spent about a month this summer in near the Mozambique border in South Africa. We're working with the area, what's known as the Venda region, which is sort of the most tropical region in South Africa. We're doing a project there in organic. So, you know, it was literally 2 weeks in the middle of the woods. Point being is that there's just such an amalgamation of people that are really interested in these things and really trying to coordinate and build their build models and virtually create these models that the group of people I speak to is just incredibly diverse, and everyone sort of shares a common passion about, using real tools, using real markets, using real skills to both make money and or make the world a slightly better place.
Thanks, Roger. I've been listening while Justine has, this is Carrie, I'm sorry, and I've been listening in while Justine has been asking some questions, and some of the answers that you have given have led me to jump in now and ask a little bit more about the strategies that your company and the other company that you are involved in developing, Blue Orchard Microfinance Securitization. Would you mind explaining for the group a bit about Blue Orchard before we get started?
Sure. And just so everyone's clear on how the pieces fit together, I was actually working at a boutique firm, a wonderful, wonderful shop called Developing World Markets. And they had been managing money in emerging markets. That was actually how I got to know them. And my former partners there had been doing some work, or, you know, had sort of donated to microfinance. They were on the advisory board. And they really came up with the idea or the possibility of a financing, and I joined them shortly after. And what we actually did for that particular raise, we at Developing World Markets were the bankers. Blue Orchard, who's a Swiss-based microfinance fund manager, had the relationships with the microfinance institutions around the world. They didn't have the banking and the structuring skills that we did, and we did not have the relationships with the MFIs that they did. So together, we actually created what was the Blue Orchard Microfinance Securitization, BOMSI-1, and we structured the transaction and we placed the transaction, and they helped in the negotiations with the MFIs. Now, at that time, we probably had, I believe, there were about 12 MFIs that were in the raise. We provided anywhere from between 1 to about 4 million. You know, it was the leading MFIs in the world, many of whom were microfinance institutions at the time, and some of whom have gone on to be commercial banks. One of the key investors was OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, whose mission is to really help U.S. businesses overseas. They came in and provided a layer of protection because their goal is to, you know, as I mentioned, promoting U.S. businesses, but sort of in a sense using economics as a tool for international diplomacy. And together we actually structured BOMSI-1, which was a $40 million raise, and then a year later did BOMSI-2, which replicated the same basic process or the same structure, but we were able to add other microfinance institutions to the mix. Some of the earliest investors included the Omidyar Foundation, Pierre Omidyar, the founder of eBay, very passionate about social change, very appreciative of financial innovation. Skoll Foundation. We had several of the faith-based groups. You know, I've grown to love nuns over the course of my career. They really, really understand these things, as do many other the faith-based groups. So we really nurtured very carefully who those first investors were. Subsequently, many more commercial investors have invested in microfinance and microcredit, but for that first offering, we really needed people who had aligned DNA, you know, who understood the novelty of what we were doing and the potential impact if we were to actually get it right. So let me pause there.
Indeed, the model of an MFI and the model of a impact investment funds requires that you relate to the people that are getting your that are your beneficiaries as much as people who are investing in your mission. And I wanted to ask you to address for a moment the model for risk monitoring, which is a joint effort between MFIs and BOMSI, one or two, I believe. It's interesting because you partner with MFIs and address the structure from both a top-down and a bottom-up perspective, top-down being a strategic positioning that BOMSI is able to provide, and the bottom-up being a credit analysis provided by the MFIs themselves. And just specifically, are there any training mechanisms so that those who are the recipients of these loans are vetted further accurately? And do investors contribute to that process?
There are really three parts to your question, and let me break it down because there are multiple. It's complicated. Part one is risk mitigation through the structure of the capital structure of the offering. And the simple way a CDO works is that you've got a base layer, and it's called a waterfall, a cash waterfall, where investors who were at the most senior level, the top of the waterfall, they were protected by the lower layers of capital, but they were also paid less. And, you know, in rough terms, the investors in the senior note got 6%, investor in the subordinated note, which was a layer down, got 7 or 8%, and investors in the second subordinated note got 8%, and the equity investors at the bottom got 15%. In reverse, if one of the MFIs were to have gone out of business, it would have wiped out some of that initial equity and so on up the chain. So step one, and this is where OPIC came in, was creating a very robust financial instrument. Step two, and this is where we work very closely with Blue Orchard, in our credit process around the microfinance institutions, we obviously looked not just at their own credit history to make sure that they were fairly viable, but we looked at the methodology around what they were using to analyze and review their own potential borrowers. We took it to the next level because your question about training the borrowers is a critical one. I don't think all of them had necessarily training facility because if the ratios were good enough, it seemed like a lot of their borrowers were already pre-screened. But one of the trends that we've noticed over the years is that many of the MFIs are very committed to sort of social services, and they would not just provide training and education, they would also be providing things like healthcare. And one of the issues as a lender is, you know, it's great from a social purpose perspective that we're lending money to an MFI, but we need to get our money back. And if they're using a certain percentage of that capital for healthcare, while from a mission side it's good, from a credit side it's actually bad. So what's happened over the years, and this is a sort of an ongoing trend, is many of the MFIs would start a foundation that is run in parallel to the actual lending facility, so that there's a real the capital which is being lent to the institution to be is ring-fenced, so the capital is on lent for other purposes versus the softer capital which can be used or sourced from other sources, so that it's not diluting the credit quality of the underlying institution. So, you know, just in review, you've got the credit analysis and risk mitigation through the structuring of the instrument. You've got the credit analysis and review of the individual MFIs themselves. And then you have the structural issues around how the MFIs are running and what programs they're implementing to make sure that the quality of their borrowers stays high.
Folks, you're listening
to BARD
Sustainable Business Fridays, and we come at you the first and fourth Friday of every month. Actually, this will be our last Sustainable Business Fridays call of the spring semester of 2014. We'll be rejoining you in the fall when we have a brand new lineup of folks to speak with. We are transcripting and excerpting these conversations in Green Biz. So we'll be sending out that out. If you'd like to sort of hear the podcast afterwards, you'll be able to access it through the transcripted version that you'll find on greenbiz.com. Today we're talking with Roger Frank, one of the founders of Commercial Microfinance and his company Innovar. And we have Justine Porter and Carrie Sinclair, who are our questioners. So with that little commercial break, we turn it back over. Oh, and let me also say that the BARD MBA in Sustainability, we are still accepting applicants for the fall. The May 15th is our official final deadline for fall admission, although we will look at qualified applicants, you know, into the early summer. So, Justine or Carrie, back to you.
Thank you, Eben. Roger, thank you so much for explaining further how the MFIs are mitigating their risk by setting up foundations and by the investment from large organizations such as OPAC, which provide a capital cushion for Blue Orchard itself. there has been in the recent past issues, particularly in Latin America, with MFIs that are charging exceptionally high interest rates to their borrowers. Do you think that this is a strategy to mitigate the risk undertook by the MFI? I know that you spoke briefly about the foundations which MFIs are setting up as a cushion against this risk. How does that tie in to these interest rate spikes?
Great question. A couple of responses as always. One, if you actually look at the rates, very often they're roughly in line with U.S. credit card rates. I don't think there are onerous in many cases. Secondly, it's expensive to run an MFI. If they don't charge these rates, they're going to be out of business. And third, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Most of them are growing dramatically. And the market is a cruel master. If the rates were too high, people wouldn't be coming back to borrow more money. So, you know, it's been my experience over time that, you know, we're putting the money lenders out of business. Those are the high rates. You know, when people are, you know, paying 100, 110%, you know, that, in my view, is just, you know, totally unsustainable. But, you know, the 20 to 30%, I mean, for these small businesses, you know, their relative cost of capital, if you break it down and the impact on their business, the market speaks for itself. You know, the default rate is less than 2%. You know, there are many, many examples of people borrowing a small sum and coming back for more as their business grows. So, you know, the market is telling us that these rates are not too high.
I agree that the rate might not be too high for an individual loan and an individual MFI. But as more and more MFIs get off the ground and the prevalence of cheap credit increases, there is a phenomenon where borrowers are starting to use, are starting to contract more loans in order to pay back existing loans. And that is a bit of an issue for people who are not trained in finance and who are not literate in the field very much. Is there a training that either Innovari or BOMSI would be facilitating for financial literacy?
Well, let me sort of answer from the point of view of my own experience, because I'm, you know, Innovari, we're focused more on ag now, but obviously I'm still pretty deeply rooted in microfinance. Let me digress, because to me the three issues are capital, technology, and the mindset around microfinance. And what's happening in a lot of countries, I remember being in Romania right after they implemented sort of credit institutions. I mean, what you're talking about is a scenario which in the world of microcredit is going to get us back to the year 2008 where people were overextended. You know, in Romania right now, as an example, you have to register loans nationally. So you don't have the ability to borrow from multiple MFIs because that information is recorded. A simple example where you have the government beginning to think about these policies and these issues so that it can create an environment to prevent these kind of things from happening. You've got the technology that you can actually track these borrowers and these loans, and ultimately it's these kind of infrastructures that are really going to make a difference. Now, a lot of the financing for this is really coming from public sources. You know, as a private sector company, no, we're not involved with training. We're not involved with education. We're a small firm. We don't have the resources for it. But a lot of the foundation capital, a lot of the development capital, a lot of these issues around creating the right policies, creating the right infrastructure, critical. And, you know, it's a much larger, the issues that you're addressing it are much bigger, and no single organization can really address them by themselves. But if you begin to think about what are the macroeconomic policies around microcredit, where have there been problems, and what can we do about it, you know, there are several globally oriented microfinance networks and organizations where these become fairly standard topics to be addressing to help the industry grow up. You know, you look at the number of people in the world and the tremendous, tremendous need for microcredit and the fact that a lot of these banks in the more developed world aren't borrowing. You know, microfinance, in my view, it's still early, early days in the game. You know, you go onto the website of the mix and you begin to look at the number of MFIs around the world. You know, there are roughly 10,000. there are probably 1,000 that are self-sustaining, if not 1,500 at this point. You know, it's early, early on. So there's a confluence of things that's happening around policy, around technology, around communication, which will hopefully avoid a lot of the kind of disaster scenarios that you've talked about. But, you know, there's no question the markets are cruel and there are going to be a lot of MFIs going to go out of business.
So would it be fair to say that your work in recently is turning a bit away from microfinance to just really more conventional, creating a more kind of conventional financial structure in a market gap that you're finding in for these kind of medium-sized enterprises, agricultural enterprises?
Yes, it's a very fair point. I mean, and I'll give you an example. We've worked as hard on this leasing program as we did for that original microfinance loan. There's nothing new about leasing, but there is a lot new about financial leasing in an African context. The whole concept of lease to own doesn't exist in many of these countries. The lack of capital, it's, you know, I mean, where we live is, you know, financial innovation. That's really what drives our work. So microfinance, there are many, many players. There are not as many players as SME finance. It's a much more complicated animal. You know, you're actually doing credit work on the institutions, whereas microcredit is more of a customer kind of process. That's a gross simplification. But to your immediate question, yes. I mean, we're seeing market gaps where creative financial solutions are needed, which can provide returns for investors, market rate returns for investors, while having a dramatic impact on people's lives. You know, back to what our strategy is, we're starting with the soy production or soy manufacturing equipment, but our ultimate goal is to have a whole turnkey solution of equipment that could be financed, which would include trucks or refrigerated trucks or other processing facilities, so that this equipment, which is the real bottleneck around food production, can be available for ultimately the SMEs and the smallholder farmers who in turn will benefit from it.
And, you know, if that gap exists in Africa, why, I mean, how was that gap resolved, or is it resolved in developed context? Just through the
It's not. The opportunity is global. I mean, you know, when I think about the opportunity and the needs, I mean, the one company that we're working with, we want to get launched in Kenya, expand to other countries in Africa, but it's a global opportunity. I mean, what's driving it? I mean, you look at the world right now. There are 7 billion people. We can't feed 7 billion. There are going to be 9 billion by the year 2050. It's our view that large ag is broken. From a nutritional perspective, the quality of the food is actually going down. I mean, go try to buy a tomato that doesn't come from New Jersey any month of the year except August. We're just not growing as much. There just isn't as much variety in the diet. Also, it's a fact that intensive agriculture is using more pesticides and using more fertilizers, and the inputs or the quality of the outputs are actually going down. So it's our view that big agriculture is broken right now. You know, we need to really think about climate-smart approaches to agriculture. I mean, you know, I was talking to the daughter of a coffee farmer in Kenya, and her grandmother, who's the coffee farmer, doesn't know when to grow her, when to plant her seeds because the climate cycles have been so disrupted. So there's a tremendous need for innovation around the technology around agriculture. And we're really at the confluence of all of these things right now. I mean, I view my work in microcredit as a warm-up act for some of the issues that we're really thinking about in terms of agriculture and food, because it's not just food. Fiber. I mean, there are parts of the world that have to think about, do you grow vegetables or do you grow cotton? You look at consumer trends around organic cotton, and the supply is virtually incredibly limited, and the demand is virtually limitless right now. So what we find so exciting about our work is not taking a sort of siloed approach and just thinking about credit, but thinking about, one, the need for financing in its most creative form, the gaps that exist, and what the opportunity is. It's virtually endless when we start to think in these terms because, you know, feeding people, clothing people when, you know, there are going to be 30% more people in just, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, as we would say in Wall Street, it's just a huge arbitrage.
Great.
Thanks. Thank you, Roger. I just wanted to mention a quote from the Innovari website that says there are opportunities to add value by improving efficiency in companies that provide agricultural inputs, manage on-farm operations, provide storage, processing, packaging, distribution, transportation, and marketing, and various other business services along the food and fiber value chain. To that point, and to the point that you have mentioned about innovating technologies that support the development of this industry and this agricultural industry in Africa and Pacific, what is Innovari currently partnering or has any plans to partner with investors, African investors, or universities to develop the capability and the capital of engineers in the mobile app field?
We take a very open source approach to our partners, and we're working when I let me break your question down to sort of a philosophic one about our partners, and then two, let me address specifically technology. To the first point, we can't do this by ourselves. I mean, we're a small shop. But we're working with really nothing less than the world's leading organizations here. And for whatever confluence of events, given who we are, given our creativity, given our passion around this stuff, we're really sitting on some extraordinary opportunities that we're catalyzing in conjunction with just some terrific global partners. Technology is part of the solution, but we spend a lot of time thinking about appropriate technology. You know, it's not a matter of the newest widget. It's a matter of the widget which is most appropriate to address the particular problems or challenges. Now, I've done a lot of work over the course of my career with Israeli tech companies who were actually some of the world leaders around telecommunications. And what's so interesting in terms of the developing world is that they don't have the archaic copper infrastructure that most of the developed world does. In fact, in many of these developed countries, the telephonic infrastructure is vastly superior to developed countries because they came so late to the party, the best technology was available at the cheapest prices. And what does this translate into? It translates into the opportunity to use these tools. For example, education on mobile apps around farmers. You know, being able to do analytics around soil and sending reports and data to say either you add water or you add a certain fertilizer to the soil. I mean, they're tremendous tools which are just really starting to come into play. Electronic payments. You know, back to your earlier question about MFIs and the infrastructure, you know, the technology is bringing the cost down dramatically of transactions. And that's just not in the world of finance, but that's actually going to be in the world of agriculture. Satellite imaging to get better predictive analysis around when to plant, you know, the kind of things that are going to be available. So it's just, you know, I feel like a kid in the candy store when they begin to think about what some of these technologies are and what the opportunities are and how big they can grow. And, you know, there's a shift in capital these days. No longer is it from the first world into the developed world, but there's a lot of developed world into developed world capital going on. So we're living just, from the perspective of all of my friends on the line here, I mean, we are just in the early stages of these global transformations, which are just going to give you a lifetime of extraordinary opportunities. You know, I've had the good fortune to be crazy enough to think that we could really make a difference in the world using business practices and using capital markets. And suddenly I'm not so crazy these days as you begin to see the momentum that's really picking up on it. But whether it's policy, whether it's technology, whether it's capital, it's all about innovation. It's all about thinking differently, because if we don't think differently, we're not going to have the world as we know it today. I mean, look at the rains that we've had the last couple of days. Look at the storms that we've had, you know, over the last few years. I mean, we're changing our planet, and this changes how we produce food, how we distribute food. This ties into nutrition. There's an incredible connectivity between all of these issues.
I'm 100% on board with you that this type of disruptive innovation emerging from emerging markets and economies is really powerful toward moving humanity in a direction where we actually get to live on this planet for the next 100 years. It sounds like you're really, really excited about that. And what percentage, how does that translate numerically? What percentage of loans is Innovari providing or planning to provide for this type of structural development in on-farm operations?
Well, I mean, at this point, we're sort of in the market, you know, doing a total of about $15 million of capital raising. I view that as a start. I mean, our leasing facility alone, you know, our goal is to have hundreds of millions of dollars under management within a couple of years. Because when you begin to think, right now, we're rolling it out in one country with one partner. We expand that to other countries in Africa. We expand that to other equipment manufacturers. I mean, you know, where we are is the boring part of the value, the ag value chain. I mean, smallholder farmers are much sexier. You know, it's a much more interesting story to tell. You know, you show a picture of a refrigerated truck and it puts people to sleep. But, you know, in the reality is, you know, you can flash freeze a vegetable and you can, it's alive for, you, or rather it's preserved for 2 weeks that you can't with fresh fruits and vegetables. The point being that, there's just a tremendous, tremendous need for capital. And, you know, even you were speaking about CSR earlier. I mean, for many, from the point of view of many corporations, no longer it is a matter of window dressing, but addressing these things as part of their core business, because at the end of the day, if they don't, there's a lot of downside risk by not thinking about what could actually happen to these corporations. And it's ultimately about good business. So there's a real alignment now, which is really starting to happen, to pull a lot of these things together. You know, thus our goal is to use these models, and, you know, BOMSI itself was an $80 million offering. We went on to manage about $500 million at my former firm. We're starting small, and with any luck at all, and fingers crossed, you know, we'll be deploying quite a bit of capital.
It's very exciting work. And actually, let me just kind of, we have just a few minutes left. I mean, one of the challenges that we're seeing, you said big ag is broken. We see small farmers here, for example, in the Hudson Valley, kind of scrambling to try and build new models of viable small and medium enterprise size farming. And, I mean, do we need capital innovation to enable them to survive? Is that the issue? You said you could see these things as sort of parallel or having multiple global applications.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we're developing in the early stages of developing some products that are U.S.-oriented. So, you know, in my ample spare time, both 2 minutes, I have been thinking a lot about U.S. food. And we've been spending a lot of time on the subject of what I call urban nutritional deserts. You know, there's no shortage of food, but there's a tremendous shortage of nutrition. You know, I was joking with somebody the other day. What I like to do is go to a 7-Eleven and ask myself the question, what's the healthiest food that I can actually find? And maybe I can find a granola bar, and if I'm really lucky, I can find a banana that's only a little brown. So the point being, you take the rich kind of potential agricultural production from the Hudson Valley, you begin to think about the metropolitan areas that have a tremendous need for improved nutrition. You know, there are a lot of groups such as Wholesome Wave and a few others out there that are really starting to think about aggregation. But from a big picture perspective, the supply exists because of the resources and the geography in the backyard around the Hudson region. But there's a market gap. And, you know, how do we all work together to close that gap? You know, it ties into, and where this is interesting is I've done a lot of work around cognition and nutrition, which ties into education, which ties into obesity, and it ties into the work that Michelle Obama is doing. So we really need to think big picture around a lot of these developmental issues, which on the surface are not ag-related, but are very much tied into economic development. And I think it's a long-winded way of saying we really need to think differently about these integrated models that will close the gap between the producers of the food and the consumers and the users of food. So I don't know. I'm still trying to figure this one out.
Great. Well, we are too, so we should think about that and have a longer conversation. In particular, this question of finance for small and medium-sized farms, how do we crack that nut? So, Justine or Carrie, do you guys have some final questions to take us out?
Thank you, Eben. Just one last question regarding the return on these investments for for small and medium farms and in developing countries specifically. How are you selling this to your investors as a return, considering that showing them pictures of refrigerated trucks isn't going to work?
Yeah, I mean, this is where a couple of years on Wall Street makes a difference. You know, at the end of the day, pricing an instrument, pricing a security is an art and a science. We do a lot of analysis around what the comps are. We look at spreads to U.S. Treasuries. We look at spreads to Euro bonds. We looked at junk bonds. We look at currency issues. And you ultimately try to come up with a return which is, on a risk-mitigated basis, justified. And you draw the line in the sand, and then one of two things happen. You show it to investors, and they say, yes, I buy your premise, or no, I need another 100 basis points. There's no magic to it. I mean, I've sold, you know, billions of dollars worth of securities over the years, and at the end of the day, the market will tell you what the rate should be. Now, there are certain constraints because we are pricing this particular offering in the context of local interest rates. So we can't come in and pay a rate that will not be supported by the local rates because then there are other sources of financing. So, as I say, it's really a bit of a science, and the rates that we've come up with, you know, we think are very attractive on a risk-mitigated basis to the point where we can try to attract the capital that we want to.
Thanks, Roger. This gives us all a lot to think about as we move forward in our respective specialties, either being finance or microfinance or developing world management programs. I don't know if there's anyone who would like to answer the question in the last minute or so that we have on this call, and I'll just open up the floor now.
Yeah, actually, I apologize. We did not even ask our audience, so let's see if there's an audience question. If you'd like to ask Roger a question, hit 5-star on your phone, 5-star on your phone. And in the while waiting for that opportunity, again, you've been listening to the Bar at MBA and Sustainability Sustainable Business Fridays conversation. I want to thank Justine Porter and Carrie Sinclair for asking Roger to join us in this fascinating conversation today. This is the last Sustainable Business Fridays call of the spring semester of 2014. We will be back in the fall of 2015 with another exciting lineup. We've had a tremendous number of great conversations, and you can look for the podcast of this conversation. We'll be publicizing that opportunity when we transcript the conversation in Green Biz. So not seeing any hands going up in our audience. So on that note, it is top of the hour, and we probably should wind it up. So, Roger, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a very fascinating conversation.
Great evening, Carrie, Justine. Thank you. It's been enjoyable on my end as well.
Thank you so much, Roger.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Take care.
Thanks so much.
Bye. Take care.